Neil beige that would become the universal color of desktop computers. Yes, I have Betty to thank for my dun-colored Dell. The second was a program she called a sort merge generator, which took specifications for data files and automatically generated routines for sorting and merging that data, keeping track of all the input and output in the UNIVAC tape units. Grace Hopper was floored by Betty's sort merge generator. According to Grace, it marked the first time a computer was ever used to write a program that wrote a program. This would have a huge influence on Grace, and indeed on the entire history of computing. But not everyone saw it that way at first. At that time, the establishment promptly told us, at least they told me quite frequently, that a computer could not write a program, Grace remembered. It was totally impossible, that all that computers could do was arithmetic, and that it couldn't write programs, that it had none of the imagination and dexterity of a human being. I kept trying to explain that we were wrapping up the human being's dexterity in the program. Indeed, thanks to the dexterity of programmers like Betty and Grace, UNIVAC was the most powerful computer in the world. Its magnetic tape programs allowed input and output speeds to finally match the speed of its electronic components. The UNIVAC dominated its competition, becoming synonymous with the technology itself. As Kleenex is to tissues and Xerox is to photocopies, in the 1950s, UNIVAC was to computers. Even a young Walter Cronkite consulted it like an oracle. On election night, 1952, a UNIVAC running a statistical program live on CBS election night coverage predicted Dwight Eisenhower's landslide victory over Adlai Stevenson when no traditional poll saw it coming. The gimmick was so popular that the computer became a regular feature on CBS. Despite their public successes, Mauchly and Eckert stumbled behind the scenes. They were academics, with good intentions inversely proportionate to their business expertise. Their stored program electronic computers were an untested, expensive technology that required a hard sell and no shortage of hand-holding for those clients who did buy in. EMCC's first major injection of capital, from a Baltimore company, American Totalizator, that made betting odds calculators for racetracks, fell to pieces after the vice president of the company died in a freak plane crash. Strapped for cash, Mauchly and Eckert tried to sell EMCC to IBM, but Big Blue wanted nothing to do with them. IBM's agent CEO, Thomas Watson Jr., didn't believe in magnetic tape and elected to stick with the proven business of punch card systems. They were forced to sell EMCC to a business machine company, Remington Rand, once the proud manufacturer of the world's two most important weapons, guns and typewriters. Selling out to Remington Rand wasn't an inspired decision, but it was grimly practical. The company had been in the punch card business for years, and they anticipated growth in the computing sector. They bought out EMCC's debts, effectively saving the company from ruin, and promised that their experienced sales teams could sell the UNIVAC in their sleep. Unfortunately, Remington Rand's senior management knew nothing about Boolean algebra, subroutines, or code. Worse, they had no clue what to do with all the women working in senior positions at EMCC. When Remington Rand bought UNIVAC, Betty Snyder recalled some years later, as far as I was concerned, that was the end of the line, because their idea of women was to sit beside a typewriter. Nobody at Remington Rand had ever worked with technical women, and they resisted the idea that a woman could lead a presentation, meet with clients, or even understand the UNIVAC installations they had designed. I mean, it was just as though they never dreamed that anybody would listen to you and take you seriously, Betty Jean Jennings complained. It would be the end of the salad days. Remington Rand had the foresight to buy the Eckert-Mauchly Computer Corporation, but they didn't know what to do with the group of free thinkers they inherited in the acquisition. It was a crisis of values that would be repeated ad infinitum in the technology business. Eckert-Mauchly was a place where brilliant women coaxed symbols into code and new ideas unraveled on every spool of magnetic tape. But that vision, and the unorthodox environment that nurtured it, struggled to sustain itself in a world of punch card tabulators. The dreamers were bought by a company who thought these idiots down in Philadelphia were insane, that nobody would buy these million-dollar machines, and there were very few applications for which they were really usable. The open and transparent company structure of EMCC was gobbled up by Remington Rand's old-school corporate hierarchy. The company's central office was in New York City, which may as well have been Mars, for all the EMCC team was able to communicate with it. Betty Snyder, who'd never had a title or a department, suddenly had a boss. That was a disaster, she said, because I'd go to him with decisions, and he'd make the wrong decisions, and I had to live with them. At EMCC, everyone had served the machine. But at Remington Rand, there were other masters, whose interests were often at odds with their work. In 1990, long after they'd all retired, a group of former Eckert Mockley employees got together at the Smithsonian Institution to get their history down on record. Even 40 years later, nobody had a nice thing to say about Remington Rand. An excerpt from that oral history. Ceruzzi, moderator. I wonder if there's anyone here who would like to defend Remington Rand management because, laughter, do we have any volunteers for this? Tonic, former UNIVAC programmer. No, not exactly. Ceruzzi, no, not at all? The UNIVAC was a million-dollar machine, but Remington Rand's salesmen were not trained to understand what it could do. They were used to tabulating machines, which ran on punch cards. Hard copies were an easy sell for office contracts, as opposed to the UNIVAC's black magnetic tape, which was unknowable, literally opaque. There was no feeling about the UNIVAC, Betty recalled, except what they were going to get out of it. The best the salesman could do was use the computer in a bait-and-switch routine. They'd bring Betty Jean Jennings to sales calls at government agencies, where she would diligently describe everything the stored program computer was capable of doing. Then they'd hustle her out of the room so that the men could sell some typewriters. It might have been better than the alternative. When Remington Rand salesmen did take a crack at selling the UNIVAC, their lack of understanding horrified the old Eckert Mockley programmers. At one point, Rem Rand hired a man unknown to anyone at Eckert Mockley to write all of the UNIVAC marketing materials and to finally train sales staff on the machine. He consulted nobody familiar with the UNIVAC. Mockley was furious. We are at a loss to understand how anyone, having accepted a position demanding experience he does not have, he banged out in a memo, would fail to seek all possible help to discharge his duties. Grace Hopper and her programming team were forced to pick up the slack. By 1950, they were pulling multiple shifts, selling and marketing the UNIVAC where Remington Rand couldn't do it effectively, and managing customer support when the client installations inevitably posed problems. They were bound to fail, even if they succeeded. Remington Rand management forcibly scaled down production of the UNIVAC to 6 a year, but after 2 years of the programmers handling sales, they'd sold 42 machines. The result was they couldn't deliver the damn things, a UNIVAC engineer, Lou Wilson, recalled at the Smithsonian meeting. Grace in particular found herself in an untenable position. She was doing the work of 3 people in a field most had trouble even defining. At Eckert Mockley, she'd been senior mathematician, sounded impressive enough to match the salary. But at Remington Rand, seniority just meant more work. Beyond managing a team of programmers and overseeing custom software projects for each client, she served as a clearinghouse for customer support. It was a constant battle. To say nothing of her side hustles, she was always furthering the art, working in what little spare time she had on improvements to programming technique. But it suited her to be busy. She'd had a rough patch in the years between Eckert Mockley's insolvency and its acquisition by Remington Rand, her alcoholism creeping back. She was even arrested for drunk and disorderly conduct in November 1949. But Howard Aiken's lab at Harvard hadn't been a pleasure cruise either, and those punishing circumstances had brought out her best ideas. The same would happen during her most trying years at Remington Rand. Chapter 4. Tower of Babel. In the early 1950s, programming wasn't well understood beyond its industry, or even within it, judging from the difficulty Grace had communicating with the sales department of her own company. Not coming from any existing art, programmers began their careers elsewhere. Some, like Grace, were mathematicians, while others were discovered through aptitude tests or were given a shot because of their affinities for crossword puzzles and plain geometry. To succeed, they had to learn their hardware exhaustively and fail constantly. This created a certain sense of earned privilege. John Backus, a computer scientist at IBM and a contemporary of Grace Hopper's, famously characterized programmers in the 1950s as a priesthood, guarding skills and mysteries far too complex for ordinary mortals. As much as the wizards appreciated shortcuts for their drudgery, they regarded with hostility and derision more ambitious plans to make programming accessible to a larger population. Grace wanted out of the priesthood. She strongly believed that computer programming should be widely known and available to non-experts. If computers weren't so painstaking to program, perhaps they'd be easier to sell. If clients could write and rewrite their own code, then her staff wouldn't have to create custom programs for each UNIVAC installation. Which would be ideal, because there were only a few really good programmers in the world, and their talents were being wasted on dreck. As the world awoke to its possibilities, the computing industry was exploding, and there weren't enough trained programmers to satisfy demand. Grace and her peers weren't getting any younger either. The field needed new blood, and it needed to become more accessible. Grace knew that would only happen when two things occurred. One, users could command their own computers in natural language. Two, that language was machine independent. That is to say, when a piece of software could be understood by a programmer as well as by its users, and when the same piece of software could run on a UNIVAC as easily as on an IBM machine, code could begin to bend to the wills of the world. Grace called this general idea automatic programming. And to anyone who knew her, it was a logical outgrowth of her Harvard work on subroutines and code documentation. She'd always liked finding ways to make programming a little easier, a little more efficient. During the war, her shortcuts saved time and lives. After the war, they saved money and heartache. To the higher-ups at Remington Rand, however, investing in automatic programming seemed like a distraction from the real business of computer sales. Why make things easier when what they were selling was expertise? Her fellow programmers had reservations, too. Grace's proposition might put them out of work. In later years, as the discussion over automatic programming grew more and more contentious, each side of the argument earned a nickname. Those who resisted automatic programming became known as the Neanderthals. They might as well have called themselves framebreakers, as Lord Byron had over a century before. The space cadets, on the other hand, believed in a bug-free future, where the programs wrote themselves, or at least pulled their own weight. As utopian as that might have seemed to the Neanderthals, who believed that programming was an expert craft, inimitable by machine, the industry-wide need for automatic programming only grew. Remington Rand hadn't anticipated how much support UNIVAC required. It became a strain on the company just to keep its clients' computers operational. Grace, who was great at pleading her case to bureaucrats, made it clear that the costs associated with programming threatened to approach the cost of hardware. Remington Rand caved. They created an automatic programming department and put Grace in charge. Her first order of business was to write a compiler, a kind of mediator program that simplifies writing code at the machine level. Just as mechanical computers replaced a generation of human calculators, making programmers of mathematicians like Grace, her compiler, the first of many intermediaries between people and machines, would once again redefine the nature of the job. The mathematician who had become a programmer would soon become, in turn, a linguist. A quick lesson. Computers do not understand English, French, Mandarin Chinese, or any human language. Only machine code, usually binary, can command a computer at its most elemental level to pulse electricity through its interconnected logic gates. Broken down, every program is just a maddeningly explicit list of instructions in this machine code about where and how electricity should move. The most basic programs specify operations at the hardware level, just one step above physically plugging a computer like the ENIAC together. And more complex programs are aggregations of these basic operations. In Grace's day, debugging required thinking like a machine, bit by painstaking bit. If the priesthood guarded one mystery above all, it was the secret to achieving limitless patience. Compilers are fundamental to modern computing. They make programming languages, with their ever higher levels of symbolic notation, comprehensible to the binary lizard brain of the computer. It's now a given that using a computer, and even programming one, requires no specific knowledge of its hardware. I don't speak binary, but through the dozens of software interpreters working in concert whenever I make contact with my computer, we understand each other. Machine code is now so distant from most users' experience that the computer scientist and writer Douglas Hofstadter has compared examining machine code to looking at a DNA molecule atom by atom. Grace Hopper finished the first compiler, A0, in the winter of 1951, during the peak of her personnel crisis at Remington Rand. The following May, she presented a paper on the subject, The Education of a Computer, at a meeting of the Association for Computing Machinery in Pittsburgh. In the paper, she explained something counterintuitive, that adding this extra step, a layer between the programmer and the computer, would increase efficiency. She used a personal example to illustrate. In the past, mathematicians like her had been stuck with the chore of arithmetic, all those tedious little steps on the way to interesting solutions. Ostensibly, a computer like the UNIVAC took over those arithmetic tasks, freeing the mathematician to think more stimulating thoughts. The reality, however, was that the mathematician became a programmer instead, again consumed by tedious little steps. Grace loved coding, but she admitted that the novelty of inventing programs wears off and degenerates into the dull labor of writing and checking programs. This duty now looms as an imposition on the human brain. Her solution was to insert a third level of operation, empowering the computer to write its own programs. It would do that by compiling selected subroutines, reusable scraps of code saved to the computer's memory, from the computer's baked-in subroutine catalog. The compiler could then automatically arrange subroutines and translate them into nitty-gritty machine code. That way, the programmer may return to being a mathematician, and the computer, on the basis of the information supplied by the mathematician, using subroutines and its own instruction code, produces a program on its own. Grace proposed that a smarter machine could support a less educated programmer, and even a non-programmer user, as its education continued. UNIVAC at present has a well-grounded mathematical education fully equivalent to that of a college sophomore, and it does not forget and does not make mistakes, she wrote, always the teacher. It is hoped that its undergraduate course will be completed shortly, and it will be accepted as a candidate for a graduate degree. Compiling subroutines, rather than hand-coding from scratch, removed a huge margin of human error from the exercise of programming. Subroutines were already tested, debugged, and ready to go. Strung together by the compiler, programs could be written in hours instead of weeks. Grace's idea, which would be successively refined by many people in the years to follow, automated much of the drudgery associated with programming, allowing programmers to focus on the creative side of their work and on the higher-level, systems-oriented thinking that would ultimately advance computer science as a discipline. More important, it represented something conceptually novel, programs writing themselves, a path Betty Holberton had illuminated with her brilliant sort-merge generator. The idea was as appealing to marketers as it was to computer manufacturers. By 1955, Remington Rand was running print advertisements with headlines like, Now, UNIVAC tells itself what to do. Grace's paper ignited the computing community, but there was work to be done. Her first compiler, A0, was elementary. It was very stupid, she explained. What I did was watch myself put together a program and make the computer do what I did. Although it smashed conventional programming techniques in speed 18-1, the machine code it created, the elemental binary instruction set the computer actually executed, remained inefficient. These days, the elegance of code is mostly aesthetic, but in the early 1950s, it was still cheaper to pay programmers to manually check programs for errors than it was to burn an extra hour of computer time with clunky machine code. Within a year, Grace and her programming staff had written a slightly less cumbersome A1 compiler. In the spring of 1953 came the A2. With each iteration, compilers grew more sophisticated, more user-friendly. A2 introduced what Grace called pseudocode, a kind of in-between language, more human than computer. It wouldn't seem particularly friendly to a modern programmer, but this shorthand was the first step toward programming languages non-experts could use. That would be Grace Hopper's legacy. Getting the ball rolling on automatic programming was a big accomplishment, but it created an entirely new set of problems. Designing compilers and pseudocode was beginning to feel like inventing new languages, more art than science. The new syntax had to hold the compiler together, while remaining coherent to users. A language is only as useful as the fluency of its speaker, after all. Grace saw the proliferation of new compilers and pseudocode as a potential Tower of Babel situation, with competing, mutually incomprehensible languages crowding each other out. She proposed a few solutions. Her influential business compiler, Mathematic, employed the globally understood language of mathematics as its lingua franca. Its descendant, Flowmatic, assigned mathematical variables to commonly used words and phrases. These natural language commands served double duty as documentation, and their relative comprehensibility made it possible for non-technical project managers to assess work being done. But the larger question remained. Could a single language be understood by every computer on Earth? The earliest meeting to discuss this question was initiated by Mary Hawes, one of Grace Hopper's former colleagues, with whom she'd co-developed Flowmatic at Remington Rand. When she buttonholed a well-known computer scientist, Dr. Saul Gorn, at a conference in San Francisco, asking if he didn't think it was time for a common business language. In April 1959, Grace called a follow-up meeting at the University of Pennsylvania, where she was adjunct faculty. Everyone in attendance agreed with Mary. The time was nigh for a shared, business-facing, hardware-independent programming language. Remington Rand wasn't the only company up to its ears in costly data installations. Grace's informal committee was full of competitors, like IBM and the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, suffering the same growing pains. But the undertaking needed a neutral and influential sponsor. Grace flexed some Navy connections and approached the Department of Defense, which at that time was running 225 computer installations with plans for many more. Only a month after the meeting at Penn, the DoD hosted the first organizational meeting of the Conference on Data Systems and Language, or CODASIL, at the Pentagon. Every major computer manufacturer sent diplomats to rub elbows with government brass and representatives from private industry. The common cause was a forward-thinking, easy-to-use language, preferably in simple English, that would be independent of any specific machine. Three committees were formed: short range, intermediate range, and long range. The first would examine existing compilers, like Grace Hopper's Flowmatic, Fortran, and the AIMICO language developed by the Air Force, to decide what worked and what didn't. After that analysis, they'd write up specifications for an interim language. The intermediate group would study language syntax and business language trends, then build on the first group's effort. Finally, the long-range group would gather all the first and second group's research and use it to create a universal business language. A rigorously tiered process with deliverables at every step along the way. Honestly, it could only have been dreamed up by computer programmers. The committees promptly went haywire. There was no such thing as an interim language. It was far too time-consuming and expensive to switch languages at all. Grace estimated that it would cost $945,000 and 45.5 man-years, the notion of kilogirl hours being long gone from the lexicon at this point, to implement a new compiler at Remington Rand. Whatever stopgap language the short-range committee created would have to be there to stay. In no way was this language going to be an interim solution, concluded Grace's old Eckert-Mockley colleague Betty Holberton, a member of the short-range committee who was, by then, supervising advanced programming at the Navy's Applied Math Lab. This language was going to be it, as far as I was concerned. This left the short-term group, which included three women. Beyond Holberton and Mary Hawes, there was Jean E. Samet from Sylvania Electric Products, also a Hopper protege, to write the new business language in fewer than 3 months. Because programmers love acronyms, the group became known as the PDQ Committee. They'd have to move mountains of code pretty damn quick. PDQ made good on their name, delivering their findings for the new common business-oriented language, COBOL, in December 1959. That following January, the specs were printed. The long-range committee was never even formed. COBOL changed the world. The Department of Defense ran all its computer installations with COBOL and insisted that suppliers provide hardware that supported it, dictating the direction of the computing industry for a decade. 10 years after its implementation, COBOL was the most widely used programming language in the industry, and by the turn of the millennium, 80% of all code on the planet was written in COBOL, representing some 70 billion lines of code. This ultimately proved to be a huge problem. Bound by the memory constraints of 1950s-era computers, Codasil had decided on a two-digit convention to display the year, so the switch from 99 to 00 in the year 2000, it was feared, would plunge the world into chaos in a much ballyhooed Y2K bug. Groups of COBOL programmers actually had to come out of retirement to squash this final and hairiest moth in the machine. It goes to show the effectiveness of Grace Hopper's efforts. The software industry, desperately needing a standard, leaped on COBOL. But even though it was a language built to save the future of programming, its designers didn't anticipate just how long it would last. COBOL was written to suit the interests of a diverse group of people. It sacrificed elegance for readability and efficiency for machine independence. It also developed a reputation for being thorny, verbose, and convoluted. Most programmers explicitly despise it. Several textbooks omit it completely. The academic computer science community, which hadn't been consulted on its design, refused to engage with it. The Dutch computer scientist Edsger W. Dijkstra famously wrote that COBOL cripples the mind, adding that its teaching should, therefore, be regarded as a criminal offense. Jargon File, a hacker dictionary that collected computer slang from the mid-1970s onward through various shared computer networks before first being published as the Hacker's Dictionary in 1983, includes what is easily the most withering definition of COBOL. COBOL, noun. Common business-oriented language, synonymous with evil. A weak, verbose, and flabby language used by code grinders to do boring, mindless things on dinosaur mainframes. Hackers believe that all COBOL programmers are suits or code grinders, and no self-respecting hacker will ever admit to having learned the language. Its very name is seldom uttered without ritual expressions of disgust or horror. COBOL's creators wrote this off as a snob reaction. Gene Sammet, one of the chairs of the Codasil Committee and a great admirer of Grace Hopper, pointed out that usefulness and elegance are not necessarily the same thing. She remembered the monumental nature of the task. COBOL represents an attempt by a group of competitors to set aside their interests and create something benefiting everyone at the table, many of whom sacrificed existing projects for business or commercial software languages. COBOL was designed by a committee, but it was technological armistice, a ceasefire for the good of the art. In Gene Sammet's estimation, Grace Hopper did as much as any other single person to sell many of these concepts from an administrative and management as well as technical point of view. For this, Grace is remembered as the grandmother of COBOL. Like a grandmother, she was responsible for the child, but did not deliver it. Her diplomatic skills brought competitors, programmers, professional organizations, the military, and clients together. Her insistence that this milestone be reached collaboratively, rather than through competition for market share, was 30 years ahead of its time. The next generation of programmers to come of age might have sneered at COBOL's unwieldy syntax, but many would employ a similar model of distributed innovation. As her biographer points out, Grace's emphasis on collaborative development and the network of volunteer programmers she mobilized predated the open source software movement by 4 decades. Further, building common languages that remained consistent even as hardware came and went would prove essential to the evolution of computing. If programmers had been forced to start from scratch every time a new computer came out, they'd have been playing catch-up for eternity. But automatic programming, and the foundation of efficiency, accessibility, and machine independence on which it was laid, cemented the possibility for programming to develop as a functional art form. Beyond Grace, many women were involved in the development of automatic programming, a disproportionate amount, in fact, even relative to the demographics of their industry. Like Betty Holberton with her Sort Merge, they developed compilers and generators. At Remington Rand, Adele Mildred Koss, a former UNIVAC programmer from the Eckert-Mockley days, created an editing generator which read the specifications of a file and automatically produced a program to transform it into different formats. The idea was refined by Nora Moser, a programmer at the Army Map Service, one of the first people to implement Grace's A2 compiler. Moser would also help out on the PDQ committee, along with 3 other women, Deborah Davidson from Sylvania, Sue Knapp from Honeywell, and Gertrude Tierney from IBM. The final six-person committee to develop COBOL specifications included two women, Gertrude Tierney and Jean Sammet, one of the first people, let alone women, to teach computer programming at a graduate level in the United States. Admittedly, the bureaucratic labor of programming standards committees and the highly technical work of compiler design are difficult to dramatize. But for many of these women, the advancement of automatic programming represented an opportunity to assert their own importance, particularly in relation to hardware engineers. A compiler, Nora Moser noted, was like a pseudo-computer, a machine made from code alone. And Grace Hopper observed that it constituted a second level of operation beyond the workings of the machine itself, reproducible and lightweight enough to be sent in the mail. This put programmers on the same level as engineers, forging connections with symbols instead of soldering wire. Like Grace, these women were overworked. Their employers often expected them to provide support to customers, in addition to writing, testing, and debugging computer code. In an exploding industry, this was nearly impossible, and in many cases counterproductive. But with both the expertise to devise solutions and the incentive to make programming easier for experts and novices alike, they were in a unique position to affect real change, and did. Grace Hopper wasn't the first woman to believe in programming, automatic or otherwise. Many of Grace's female peers worked tirelessly to develop and standardize programming strategies that would transform the early computer industry, just as Ada Lovelace had made the mental leap from hardware to software a century before. But although the difference engine was never finished, and the analytical engine was only imaginary, she knew, just as Grace did, a computer that only does one thing isn't really a computer. It's just a machine. Chapter 5. The Computer Girls. In 1967, the April issue of Cosmopolitan ran an article, The Computer Girls, about programming. The Computer Girls, the magazine reported, were doing a whole new kind of work for women in the age of big, dazzling computers, teaching the miracle machines what to do and how to do it. Just as a woman 20 years previous might have chosen a career in education, nursing, or secretarial work, today, its author implied, she might consider computer programming. In the photographs accompanying the article, an IBM systems engineer named Ann Richardson is pictured handling punch cards, flipping switches, and feeding facts into the computer. Looking chic in a striped sleeveless blouse and a neat beehive, she's surrounded by faceless men in identical suits who look down at her as she smiles brightly, a miniskirt among the mainframes. Grace Hopper, by then in her early 60s, was back in active Navy service, heading a programming languages group in the Navy's Office of Information Systems Planning. Quoted in the Cosmopolitan article, she used one of her favorite analogies about women and programming, comparing writing programs to planning a dinner party. You have to plan ahead and schedule everything so it's ready when you need it. It may seem like a reductive statement from someone who would eventually develop a fleet-wide tactical system for nuclear submarines, but that was Grace's style. Practical applications were the most important thing, and she always connected computers to living, breathing, everyday life. But the last word in the Cosmopolitan article comes from a male programmer. "Of course we like having the girls around," he declares. "They're prettier than the rest of us." Something happened to the generation of programmers after Grace Hopper and her peers. Although the Cosmo article suggests that women were being encouraged to pursue programming as an alternative to secretarial work, the field was quickly becoming far less welcoming to women than it had even a decade before. Some estimates peg female programmers as between 30 and 50% of the workforce throughout the 1960s. But instead of running departments and advancing the art, they were starting to cluster at the lower end of the occupational pool, in lower status jobs like key punch operator, the 1960s equivalent of data entry, punching little holes into paper cards all day long. At the same time, technology pundits wrote often and lustily about a software crisis plaguing the computing industry. Due to a massive shortage in skilled programmers, software projects were coming in late, under specifications, and riddled with bugs. Many of these were dramatic public failures. In the early 1960s, IBM delivered the OS 360 operating system a year late and four times over budget. And NASA was forced to destroy the Mariner 1 spacecraft, intended to probe the mysteries of Venus, because of a simple programming error. Writing programs may be like planning a dinner party, but it also demands perfection on a level unlike any previous human undertaking. A single misplaced comma can send a rocket tumbling back to Earth. If one character, one pause, of the incantation is not strictly in proper form, the magic doesn't work, wrote Frederick Brooks, who managed the disastrous OS 360 operating system at IBM. This can make programming difficult to learn. In the early decades of the field, it's also what made it resistant to the industrial production that would drive the growth of the computer hardware business. Writing software is like writing poetry, with the unforgiving precision of equations, and it has a practical capacity to impact human lives on an unprecedented scale. Some historians have attributed the software crisis to the disproportionate development of hardware and software. As faster, brawnier computers came into use, programmers were helpless to catch up. Others have cited a personality clash between programmers, if not women, then uniquely creative, difficult, and occasionally arrogant men, and their straight-laced industrial and governmental managers. But there's a third view, one that reflects how the software crisis coincided with the long, slow decline of women in senior programming positions throughout the industry. By the late 1960s, even as Cosmo was pushing programming as a neat alternative to answering office phones, women in computing were being paid significantly less than their male counterparts. In a tradition dating all the way back to those 19th century human computing offices that hired women to save money, female programmers were paid about $7,763 a year, compared with a median $11,193 yearly salary for men doing the same job. This wage discrimination, combined with a structural unwillingness on the behalf of computer companies to make space for childcare obligations, drove women from the industry. Meanwhile, the software crisis grew so severe that NATO called an international conference in 1968 to address the problem. No women were invited. It was held in the Bavarian ski resort town of Garmisch. Between runs down the Zugspitze, the men attending banged out a new approach to programming, one they hoped would rein in some of the problems plaguing the computing industry. The most significant change they made, arguably, was semantic. Programming, they decided, would heretofore be known as software engineering. As such, it would be treated like a branch of engineering, rather than a rogue, wild-blooming field roamed by fiercely independent, self-directed misfits and women. Engineering is a job with clear credentials, not a shadowy priesthood. This change signaled a larger renegotiation of computing's professional status that would unfold through professional journals and societies, hiring practices, and certification programs throughout the 1960s and 1970s. The more the discipline professionalized, the more it grew implicitly masculine. The introduction of formal educational prerequisites for programming jobs, for example, made it harder for self-taught programmers to find employment, a change that penalized female candidates, particularly those who might have taken time off from school to raise children, above all. If computer programming began as women's work, writes historian Nathan Ensminger, it had to be made masculine. The shift from programmer to software engineer was an easy enough signal for female programmers to interpret. The new paradigm, subtle as it may seem, brought with it unspoken ideas about which gender could best elevate the practice and status of programming, Janet Abate writes. She argues that this symbolic exclusion, in concert with the more concrete factors at play, wage discrimination, lack of childcare, lack of adequate mentoring and support, signaled to women to avoid computing, just as it was suffering from an industry-wide shortage of talent. Salt in the wound, the skills female programmers brought to the table were precisely those software engineering desperately needed. The software crisis, after all, was one of deliverables. The reason projects were routinely coming in late and over budget was because they were built on rickety expectations. Getting the initial requirements right for a piece of software requires being able to listen to the client, to parse messy, real-world problems into executable programs, and to anticipate the needs of non-technical users. Despite its reputation as a discipline for introverted perfectionists, social skills are valuable in programming, even essential. Grace Hopper understood this, and it's her early self-education in a wide range of non-technical fields that made her such a profoundly competent programmer. As she told a historian in 1968, to make the link between the computer people and the outside world of clients, problems, and possible applications, you needed people with more vocabularies. Those vocabularies aren't innately feminine, but soft skills of communication are certainly socialized as women's values. During the software crisis, aspects of software design that rely on stereotypically feminine skills of communication and personal interaction were devalued and neglected, ignored by male programmers and skipped over in software engineering curricula. As a result, the industry suffered, and perhaps suffers still. The first computers became obsolete before they became operational. The Mark I led to the Mark II, then III. No sooner was the design for the ENIAC frozen and construction begun that John Mauchly and J. Presper Eckert were inventing its successor. Those early computers had a shelf life of only a few years before something smaller, faster, and smarter came along, a pattern that has continued breakneck into the present day. The same can be said for programming, which leapfrogged from a tedious afterthought to an art form in less than a decade. In 1950, when the most competent adding machines on Earth required entire office floors of real estate, IBM predicted the global market for computers would be 5 total. But 2,000 computers were in use globally by 1960. In the 1990s, when I finally came online, IBM was selling 40,000 systems a week. Punched cards became magnetic tape, as code became language, while transistors seeded to integrated circuits and then microprocessors, miniaturizing in exponential leaps as the boxes housing them sprouted screens and keyboards, becoming household objects and portals for work, play, and connection. When I think of the first female computers, poring over tables of numbers and organized groups, I sense a hidden catalyst, something that seems to have ignited a sequence of events leading to our current, intractably technological condition. The women who invented programming, working as mediators between metal and mind, grew into the women who wrote the elegant abstractions of language that allowed us to talk to computers like we talk to people. Their innovations are a little harder to grasp than those that miniaturized and refined computer hardware. The ENIAC is in pieces, 40 units scattered in museums across the country. But it's still a thing, proof of its own existence. The ENIAC programs, however, were operations conducted in time. They existed only in those brief moments when electricity pulsed through the daisy chain of patch cables strung together for the task before being unplugged and rearranged again and again. The architects of those fleeting arrangements, the kilo girls, computer girls, operators, programmers, whatever you want to call them, changed the world. As the cultural theorist Sadie Plant writes so elegantly, when computers were vast systems of transistors and valves which needed to be coaxed into action, it was women who turned them on. When computers became the miniaturized circuits of silicon chips, it was women who assembled them. When computers were virtually real machines, women wrote the software on which they ran. And when computer was a term applied to flesh and blood workers, the bodies which composed them were female. With our 21st century brains, we all have a shot at being as clever as Ada Lovelace, the Harvard computers, or a wartime ballistics calculator at Penn. But there's only so far we can reach before we hit the ultimate threshold, the glass ceiling over all humanity. My current machine, a top-of-the-line slice of MacBook Pro, will be obsolete by the time these words make it to ink. The machine code that Grace Hopper dreamed would someday write itself is now the engine that powers the world. It has allowed me to find the women we'll meet in this book, to email them out of the blue, to wave hello to their ever less pixelated faces, and to make plans ending with me in their living rooms, looking at manuals, looking at photos, drinking green tea. Such is the case with world-changing technologies. It's never easy to anticipate what they will become, or just where they will take you. Part 2. Connection Trip. Chapter 6. The Longest Cave. The longest cave in the world is in central Kentucky. Its limestone passages stretch 400 miles beneath the earth, in twisting patterns as intricate as the roots of the ancient hickory forests above. Inside, cavers skirt bottomless pits, pass fountains of orange stone, and discover deep, icy, subterranean rivers. Between the sunlit world and the depths below, white mist swirls at ankle height, like the breath of ghosts. Kentuckians have fought bitterly to control access to the secrets of Mammoth Cave. In the early 20th century, hardscrabble locals conned tourists into the sinkholes on their land, spurring cave wars that ceased only when the National Parks Department took control, evicting landowners and installing staircases, subterranean toilets, and even a grand dining room 267 feet below ground, its ceiling encrusted with snowballs of gypsum crystal. Serious cavers now enter Mammoth's wild entrances through locked grates, using keys granted by the Parks Department. They bring with them small carbide headlamps to keep warm and light the darkness. The earliest people to map Mammoth were enslaved, installed underground by landowners to lead tours. The first of these guides, Stephen Bishop, named its features the River Styx, the Snowball Room, Little Bat Avenue, and discovered the eyeless white fish that swim in its deepest waters. When Bishop was sold, along with the caves, to a Louisville doctor, he was ordered to draw a map from memory. As cave maps do, his drawing looked like a bowl of spaghetti dumped on the floor, but it detailed the nearly 10 miles of passages that Bishop had discovered and remained the most thorough map of Mammoth's reaches for more than 50 years. One nameless noodle, a passage forking off the subterranean Echo River, became important a century after Bishop was buried near the cave's main entrance, his grave marked by only a cedar tree. In Bishop's lifetime, every landowner in central Kentucky claimed a cave entrance. If not a natural sinkhole, then a crevice blown open with dynamite. Bishop believed that all these fragments were linked into one larger system, and his instinct was shared by generations of Kentucky cavers. At the bitter end of their remotest passages, the caves breathe. Cold air whispers, even miles below the surface, and water siphons deeper and deeper into the earth. Proving Bishop's connection theory became the cause of the Cave Research Foundation, a ragtag group of caving enthusiasts who spent nearly 20 years linking the disparate caves neighboring Mammoth into a single Flint Ridge system. It was a family affair. Once they were old enough, children who grew up playing in the woods surrounding the Foundation's clabbered lodge pushed past the farthest points surveyed by their mothers and fathers. By 1972, the Cave Research Foundation had surveyed nearly every Flint Ridge lead to its endpoint, sometimes with 10-hour belly crawls through womb-like tunnels. The final connection, as they called it, was imminent. The cavers believed that Flint Ridge met Mammoth past a choke of sandstone boulders at survey point Q87, a remote spur miles from the surface. But moving the boulders with lengths of metal pipe was back-breaking work. One expedition tried an alternate route, through a vertical crevice called the Tight Spot. Caving humor has a nihilistic streak. The Tight Spot is a dark slit so small that only one person in the party dared enter. She was a reedy computer programmer, all of 115 pounds, named Patricia Crowther. Pat wedged herself into the Tight Spot and came out the other end onto a mud bank. In the cool carbide light, she spotted the calling card of a previous visitor, the initials PH engraved on the wall. Back at the surface, Her party kept the discovery secret. Anyone familiar with the area would know the legend of old Pete Hansen, who had explored Mammoth before the Civil War. Those had to be his initials down there, which could only mean one thing. Flint Ridge and Mammoth were connected in a single contiguous cave spanning 340 miles. The monumental discovery would come to be known as the Everest of speleology. Pat returned to broach the juncture 10 days later. "By the way, Pat, you're leading this one," the other cavers told her. Just beyond the tight spot, they waded into muddy water up to their chests, until only a foot of air separated the subterranean river and the dripping cave ceiling. Soaked through and caked with mud like chocolate frosting, they struggled to keep their headlamps dry. Eyeless crayfish skittered around their waists. When the passage opened, it revealed a wide hall, where they glimpsed the edge of a hand railing, a tourist trail in the heart of Mammoth Cave. The link was complete. Only moments before, they'd been farther afield than any cavers in history. Now, weeping and falling over each other in the water, they were only a few steps away from a public restroom. Riding to base camp in the back of a park ranger's pickup, they looked up at the stars, bright in the summer sky. Lying in the open truck bed, with the treetops filing past overhead and falling away behind into the darkness, they contemplated their feat in silence. The long drive reinforced its magnitude. Had they really traveled these 7 miles underground? Their final passage, through the tight spot and beyond what would come to be known as Hansen's Lost River, joined an unmarked line on Stephen Bishop's hand-drawn 1839 map. After hamburgers and champagne at dawn, they slept. "It's an incredible feeling," Patricia wrote in a journal account of the trip. "Being part of the first party to enter Mammoth Cave from Flint Ridge. Something like having a baby. You have to keep reminding yourself that it's really real, this new creature you've brought into the world that wasn't here yesterday. Everything else seems new, too. After we wake up on Thursday, I listen to a Gordon Lightfoot record. The music is so beautiful, it makes me cry." The new creature Patricia felt she had brought into the world had always been there, slumbering in the darkness of geologic time. What she'd given birth to that day was not the cave, but the map. Not the thing, but its description. By wedging herself into the tight spot and bringing her lamplight to the darkness, she moved an earthly place into the symbolic Cartesian plane. Or at least that's how she might have seen it, being the party's mapmaker. Back home in Massachusetts, Pat and her husband Will ran a map factory, tracking the cartographic data each Cave Research Foundation expedition surfaced. Both being programmers, they brought considerable technical sophistication to mapmaking. As Pat described it, the couple typed raw survey data from muddy little books into a teletype terminal in their living room, which was connected to a PDP-1 mainframe computer at Will's workplace. From this data, they generated plotting commands on huge rolls of paper tape. Using a program Will wrote, Pat contributed a subroutine to add numbers and letters to the final map, which they carried over and plotted using a salvaged CalComp drum plotter attached to a Honeywell 316 that was destined to become an ARPANET IMP. The Crowthers maps were simplified line plots, but they represent some of the earliest efforts to computerize caves, a leap in technical sophistication made possible by the hardware to which they had access. A PDP-1 mainframe and a Honeywell 316, a 16-bit minicomputer, both far beyond consumer grade. Will Crowther's employer was Bolt, Baranek & Newman, BBN, a Massachusetts company that specialized in advanced research. In 1969, BBN was contracted by the U.S. government to help build the ARPANET, the military and academic packet-switching network that spawned our present-day internet. A few years after they used it to plot their cave maps, the Honeywell 316 minicomputer was repurposed and ruggedized to become an interface message processor, or IMP, what we now call a router. These routers formed a subnetwork of smaller computers within the ARPANET, shuffling data around and translating between primary nodes, a vital component of the internet, then and now. Will was one of the strongest programmers at BBN, and his tight, frugal code expressed his fastidious manner. A lifelong mountaineer, he taught Patricia to climb the vertical faces of New York's Sean Gum Mountains, and was known to hang from his office door by his fingertips while deep in thought. Will was a caver, too, and the couple spent all their vacations deep underground. "I get cold when he's not keeping me company," she wrote in one caving diary. "There's quite a draft here. The cave's breathing." Will didn't come along on the final connection trip. He'd been at Patricia's side on earlier surveys, pushed to his limit in the underground wilderness. But the final survey fell in early September, right as their daughters, Sandy and Laura, aged 8 and 6, respectively, were headed back to school. One of the Crowthers had to stay home, buy the girls their books and school clothes, take them to the dentist, and register them for classes. Will knew how much the expedition meant to Patricia. She had, after all, found the lead, what cavers call going cave, and she was dying to see it through. He told her to go ahead. He'd take care of the girls. When Pat came home, deeply moved by the experience, Will was waiting for her. They stayed up late, holding each other and talking about the connection. When Will fell asleep, Pat crept to the teletype terminal in the living room and entered, as quietly as she could, the bearings of the survey they'd made in Kentucky. She ran a coordinate program, and the data spooled into her hands in the form of a long paper tape. In the morning, Pat and Will brought the tape to his office, and she watched the BBN computer plot the link she'd made beneath the earth between two vast and lonely places. "Now I can sleep," she wrote. Caving is unforgiving. Until the late 1960s, anyone entering Mammoth would have passed the glass-topped coffin of Floyd Collins, a country caver who died pinned by a boulder. Cavers become enveloped by the earth, their every move constrained by walls and ceilings of rock. They eat very little, candy bars and canned meat, and carry their waste with them back to the surface. They have no sense of time. Emerging, they may be surprised to see the moon. As the Crowthers' friends Roger Brucker and Richard Watson wrote in The Longest Cave, their account of the connection trip, "The route is never in view, except as you can imagine it in your mind. Nothing unrolls. There is no progress. There is only a progression of places that change as you go along." Making the route visible is the central pursuit of serious caving. The Cave Research Foundation had a group doctrine: no exploration without survey. A map is the only way to see a cave in its entirety, and making maps is caving's equivalent of summiting mountains. It's also a survival mechanism. To stay safe, cavers map as they go, working rationally and systematically to locate known passages. It's no wonder the hobby attracts computer programmers. Code is a country populated by the fastidious. Like programmers, cavers may work in groups, but they always face their challenges alone. Not long after the connection trip, Patricia and Will's marriage deteriorated. They divorced in 1976, after a separation that left Will pulled apart in various ways. Caving without Patricia, in the company of their mutual friends in the small Cave Research Foundation community, had become awkward. Alone and surrounded by their maps, including an extensive survey of the bedquilt section of Mammoth they'd made together in the summer of 1974, he consoled himself with long Dungeons and Dragons campaigns and late nights coding at home. When Sandy and Laura visited their father, they usually found him hard at work on a long and elegantly structured string of Fortran code. He told them it was a computer game, and that when he was done, it would be theirs to play. The novelist Richard Powers once wrote that software is the final victory of description over thing. The painstaking specificity with which software describes reality approaches, and sometimes even touches, a deeper order. This is perhaps why Will Crowther felt compelled to make One last map. This one wasn't plotted from his wife's muddy notebooks, but rather from his own memories.